Welcome to Apostrophe Cast. This week, we bring you Mary Philipp Sandy and her explorations in God and country. As she investigates notions of freedom, motorcycles, and Christian rock, her descriptions fall squarely to give us a portrait of the implications and accessories of belief, as well as her own hometown in rural Maine.
Soon after I finished college and went home to Waterville, a fundamentalist church called Faith Free Evangelical purchased an old movie theater on the western edge of town. The theater had been failing slowly but steadily, its carpets going uncleaned, its dim marquee advertising movies too lame for even the most bored teenagers. Everyone assumed that the theater's corporate owner, a national chain, was ready to cut its losses and lock the door for good. No one I knew had any sentimental attachment to the place. What really concerned people was the fate of the structure itself. Central Maine towns like mine have become accustomed to discussing the fate of empty buildings, mills, factories, department stores. These conversations are laced with worry because everyone knows what becomes of small towns in which the empty buildings outnumber the busy ones. People hoped that someone would buy the old movie theater, refurbish it, take advantage of its convenient location on a major road between the interstate and Main Street. It seemed like a good investment for a smart business. The faith-free evangelicals, meanwhile, had been holding services in a little building next to a U-Pick strawberry place out on the town line. Their congregation began as a home-based Bible study, eventually growing enough to warrant the hiring of a professional pastor. They found an assertive, pinkish-blonde man named Bill, who came from the Midwest in 1990 to take over the congregation. No one paid much attention to the faith-free evangelicals back then. There were only a couple hundred of them. Bill's teenage children joined the rest of us at Waterville High, and they were polite and well-liked, even though they were from away. I knew little of their church, and that was fine with me. But then Pastor Bill began appearing on community radio programs and the paper's editorial page, condemning evils like homosexuality and abortion and internationalism and what he saw as a liberal bias against religion in Waterville, in Maine, everywhere. Local opinion about Pastor Bill was divided. A few people said it was about time a real Christian spoke up, and others, a majority, I thought, said it was high time for him to shut up or grow up or go back where he came from. I made a habit of reading letters to the editor on the days immediately following one of Bill's columns to see what he'd provoked, to tally the number of responses I agreed with versus the handful of responses that gave me an indignant thrill. For a long time, my understanding of religion in Central Maine went something like this. First, there were Catholics like my family, and we worshipped in a parish of three large Roman Catholic churches. Thanks to the Lebanese who had come to work in the mills at the turn of the century, there was also a small Maronite church on the riverbank in Waterville, facing the old paper mill. After the Catholics came the Episcopalians, then Unitarians, then Baptists, who sang better than Catholics, and then there was the beautiful, mysterious synagogue where Rabbi Krinsky presided. After high school, I became aware of more churches around town, organizations I'd never heard of, with denominations listed in the yellow pages as non-denominational or Bible or Church of God or simply Christian. Sometimes, driving through the fields and small towns that make up central and western Maine, I'd notice a modest structure the size of a house or convenience store, unremarkable except for a spiritual exhortation spelled out on a roadside sign. Jesus saves, it might say, or Christian fellowship. These signs were usually the same kind actual convenience stores used to advertise things like hot meatball grinders and shiners. I chalked it all up to the natural instinct to advertise what you're offering to the people who might need it, that and local color. By the time the old movie theater closed at the turn of the millennium, the faith-free evangelicals had outgrown their church by the strawberry field. They made arrangements to purchase the theater in furtherance of their mission, which they summarized brusquely as get 'em, ground 'em, grow 'em for good works unto God. Regardless of what anyone thought of Pastor Bill and his evangelicals, there wasn't a soul in town who wouldn't admit the old movie theater looked better when they were done with it. They painted it, landscaped the premises, and repaved the parking lot, which had been cratered by ice heaves. They hauled out the projectors and popcorn machine, but they kept the marquee over the parking lot, using it to write things like, "The Bible, the best adventure story ever told." It wasn't the commercial development we had hoped for, but at least a dismal eyesore had been replaced by something bright and clean and full of activity. A few years after the evangelicals moved into the cinema, at the height of the electric summer preceding the 2004 presidential election, I happened to be driving past the Faith Free Church. I glanced up at the marquee, expecting to see a familiar quip like, "Rated G for God." Instead, the black plastic letters read, "God and Country Motorcycle Rally for the Troops Today, 11 a.m., free BBQ." I considered this while I sat at the stoplight by the turn to the church. Given the state of politics in our country, and given the rumors I'd heard about the numbers of people joining Faith Free Evangelical, and given the fact that I have a casual interest in motorcycles and a far deeper interest in community gatherings, I decided to put on my signal and pull into the parking lot. Rows of motorcycles filled the center of the lot, and a line of barbecue grills stood by the entrance of the church. Cars were arranged along the perimeter, slipping off the blacktop and onto the weedy edges of the field out back. I parked and walked toward the motorcycles. There was a large flatbed truck sitting directly in front of the church. It appeared to be a stage setup with a red drum kit and several Marshall stacks. There was a platform with sound equipment facing the truck and merchandise tables to either side. A dozen fancy motorcycles were lined up on the lawn that separated the church from the roadway. People knelt in front of the bikes to get a better look. It was just past 11, the kind of brilliant day that explains why some people come to Maine for a summer and wind up staying for the rest of their lives. Everyone in the parking lot was sticking close to their motorcycles, not moving around much. I saw no sign of Pastor Bill, but there were evangelicals everywhere clad in neon green t-shirts, emblazoned with the church's name on the front and volunteer on the back. They darted through clusters of bikers in black leather, carrying cables to the stage or pans of brownies to the youth group's bake sale table. I didn't recognize any of them. The only activity for the moment was at the bike show, where several men stood around debating the finer points of engine mechanics and custom paint jobs. Some of the motorcycles were three-wheeled contraptions called trikes, meant to be ridden with legs outstretched. A shy young man was standing in front of a purple trike, swimming in an oversized volunteer t-shirt and clutching a sheaf of inspirational tracts. He offered me one and introduced himself as Ray. I asked how long he'd been a member of the church. "Only a week," he said. "It ain't been long, but I'm glad I came. Things was getting real bad in my life, I mean, what with being on probation and out of work and all, but I decided I was going to turn things around, and I did." He brushed a lock of limp brown hair out of his eyes and asked if I liked the purple trike. I said I did. He offered to introduce me to his uncle Roland, who had built it in his garage. "Hey," he yelled. "Hey, Roland, come here." Roland shuffled over, short and squat, with fierce lines across his forehead and a stiff brush of white hair. He was at most 5'2", completely solid, as though he'd begun life as a taller man, but got compacted somewhere along the way. He was wearing a sleeveless leather vest that exposed faded ink up and down both arms, and he was very hard of hearing. "She likes your trike," Ray yelled into his left ear. Roland looked at me. "You built this yourself?" I asked. Ray poked his uncle. "I built it," he said. "How long have you been building trikes?" I asked. "Oh, 5 years," he said. "Is this what you do for work? I mean, for a living?" Roland let out a little bark that seemed to indicate laughter. "Hobby," he said, "but I'll sell it to you if you want it." There was a bit of silence as we studied the trike, its chrome details gleaming. "It's really nice," I said. Ray asked Roland if maybe he could stop by sometime next week and start helping out in the garage, seeing as he was out of jail and didn't have work yet. "Nothing to stop you," Roland said. "I can help with the trikes, maybe learn to build them like you," Ray said. Roland twitched his shoulders. "Oh, don't know about that, but you can sweep up if you stay out of trouble." "Okay," Ray said. I thanked Roland, wished Ray luck with his probation, and bid them farewell. On stage, the show was starting. Three massive bearded bikers had climbed up on the flatbed truck to tune their instruments while a church volunteer in khakis and the ubiquitous green t-shirt tapped a handheld mic at the side of the stage. He cleared his throat and gestured to the soundboard. "Hey there, everybody," he said. "Now, folks, right now, let's give it up for Raging Grace." And here he made the kind of high-pitched hooting sound that balding men in khakis should never make. The audience responded with polite applause as the band launched into their first song. The bluesy music was punctuated by the sound of engines as more and more bikers streamed into the parking lot, screeching to a stop in formation with the other bikes. There were hundreds of people in the parking lot now and not a familiar face among them. I tried without success to think of the last time I had attended a public gathering in central Maine without running into at least five people I had known for years. A grandmotherly woman snapped her fingers to Raging Grace, who sounded like they would be right at home at the Shay down on Water Street or the Bob Inn over by the river or any other beery small town dive. "Our next one's called Nineveh," announced the singer solemnly. He pressed his mustache to the microphone and began to sing. "I was running away from Nineveh. I was hiding from the light. You know, the darkness hates the candle, but that candle's burning bright." A little girl, maybe 10, skipped past me. She was wearing a West Coast Choppers t-shirt. The band winced mean guitar faces and hit the chorus. "I say, Jesus, I hear you knocking at my heart's door. Now just come on in. You know you're welcome here. I'm not a runnin' anymore. A man in a plaid shirt and shorts stood beside me, transfixed by raging grace. He rocked back and forth on his heels, singing along to every word. He nudged me. There's something, huh? They sure are, I said. I tell you, I'm part of the blues scene, the rock and roll generation, the man went on, adjusting his clip-on sunglasses. That's where I come from. Now, this, you see, just because it's loud, well, you listen to the lyrics, it's still Christian. He was beaming with delight. The song ended, and he raised his arms over his head, clapping and waving at the band. It was getting on to lunchtime now, and people were forming lines over by the barbecue, loading up paper plates with hamburgers and hot dogs on Nissin rolls, grabbing crinkly bags of Humpty Dumpty chips. Everyone from infants to grandparents was covered in slogans and sayings on their chests and backs and arms and heads. People, churchgoers, I assumed, milled about in shirts and caps that said things like, America rocks, and Jesus is my boss, and Operation Iraqi Freedom. They mingled with bikers in fringed leather jackets covered in patches, Christian Motorcycle Association, Vulcan Riders, on fire for Jesus. Some had hand-painted the backs of their jackets with crosses and flames and roses and more messages, Jesus loves bikers too, in memory of Jesus. The merchandise tables next to the stage were piled with black Raging Grace t-shirts. The band's logo was a white electric guitar whose neck grew into a cross. There were also patches and bumper stickers for sale, everything black with white lettering, many of the items making variations on the Hell's Angels logo. I picked up a sticker with Gothic letters spelling out AFFA. What does this mean? I asked the woman smoking a cigarette behind the change box. Angel forever, forever an angel, she replied. Next to the stickers were stacks of paperback books entitled Fallen Angel. The cover showed a tough-looking motorcycle rider whom I took to be the author, Barry Mason. I picked one up. That's Barry's book, the woman said. She pointed to some video cassettes nearby. And that's his video, Hell's Angel to Heaven's Saint. Testimony. Have you ever seen Barry? I haven't, I said. He's a speaker today, she said. He come all the way up here on his motorcycle, you'll see. The band took a break. In the sudden quiet, I decided to find out who was responsible for organizing the day's events. Pastor Bill didn't seem to be around, and I wasn't sure what I would ask him anyway. I only knew him the way I knew the other big fish in our small pond, the people whose activities provided fodder for discussion on Main Street. Besides, his absence hardly mattered. He had dispatched more than enough members of his congregation. A church volunteer told me the event was co-sponsored by the United Bikers of Maine, and I should look for Ziggy, their representative, if I really wanted to know what was going on. I found Ziggy in a shady corner by the bike show. He was perhaps 40, leaning against a pickup truck with his arms folded, gazing into the middle distance. Ziggy had a long ponytail, deep bronze skin, a lot of black leather, and a statuesque calmness about him. I heard you were one of the people in charge of all this, I said. Ziggy grunted. And it's to support the troops? He digested the question for a long moment. Not really. But that's what the sign says. I pointed to the marquee. Oh, well, yeah, but it's really a Jesus thing. He straightened his back and uncrossed his arms. Who are you? I'm just from around here, I said. Oh, okay, Ziggy said. A younger woman with tight jeans and heavy mascara was also leaning on the truck. What, you were driving by and you stopped in? Something like that, I said. Well, that's awesome. Welcome. She patted my shoulder. I noticed that her arms were telltale tan. Are you a biker? You bet, she said proudly. I've been riding bikes for a long time, me and my husband. And do you go to the church here? Not here, but I am a Christian, she said. I'm actually a reverend. My name's Reverend Cynthia. And see that guy over there? That's my husband, Reverend Jeff. What church are you reverends of? We're the church Tabernacle of Power over in Fairfield. Right now, it's just our garage. God hasn't seen fit to give us a congregation just yet, but every week we... Oh, it's starting again. We turned our attention back to the stage on the flatbed truck. The MC was passing out microphones to a clean-cut 50-something couple and a man in a National Guard uniform. The soldier spoke first, saying that when he arrived at the Bangor airport following a tour of duty in Iraq, the well-wishers who greeted him caused him to choke up. He choked up a little in the retelling and earned fantastic applause, then introduced the couple behind him as the Mishus, who had a story to tell. Kathy Mishu took the microphone and explained that her son Jason was stationed with an infantry division somewhere in Iraq. He'd been told to pack personal items for a few weeks, but he'd been there for months with no end in sight. He'd run out of necessities like toothpaste and deodorant, so she and her husband decided to start collecting supplies to send him and his friends. Reverend Cynthia tapped my arm. She was holding a blue plastic bag from the Walmart up the road. I picked up some stuff for the troops' donation table, she said. Figure I'll do what I can. I sure do hope they come home soon. I know George Bush wants to get them out of there. He just can't yet. My cousin-in-law's over there, and what they're doing is so important. They're building schools and fixing houses. It's God's work, you know? I didn't know, but I didn't want to start an argument, so I nodded politely. Those poor people in Iraq deserve to have their homes and schools, Reverend Cynthia said. They deserve to live their lives, you know, and thanks to President Bush, now they can, and he's going to get the troops home just as soon as it's possible. I know it. Kathy Michoud was reading aloud from thank you letters she and her husband had received. They had sent over 200 boxes of donations to Iraq with the help of their bingo club. This one's from Specialist Sean, she announced. It says, hey, how are you? This is Specialist Sean, a friend of your son, Jason. I'm thankful for all the stuff you sent. I passed it out to the troops here. You ask, is there anything you need? Whatever you send will be fine. Our word of thanks is all we can say. I wish we could return to you more. Take care of yourself. Signed, Specialist Sean. Reverend Cynthia pounded the palms of her hands together. I have one more, Kathy Michoud said. Her husband stood silently by her side. This one is from Marine Corporal Poulin, whose grandmother is from over in Winslow. It says, greetings from Iraq. I would like to give a brief thanks to all the folks helping us out. If only you could see the looks on the Marines' faces when they receive mail. It is truly unbelievable. The mail is what keeps us going out here. We are thinking of all of you, family, friends, veterans, everyone. We can't wait to be home. Signed, Marine Corporal Poulin. The applause sounded like a roar. It was past one, and my face was flushing from the sun. People were unloading shopping bags full of donations at the tables by the stage, a steady line of Good Samaritans. I felt briefly guilty for not having anything to donate. Then I felt guilty for feeling guilty for not supporting an unjust war. Then I reminded myself that the wrongness of the war did not mean that young people my age from my town should go without toothpaste, or did it? The Michouds waved. We started this as a mom and dad thing for our son over there, Kathy said. Now we just thank God for all you guys out there bringing donations today. Thank you. God bless. Yes, yes, amen, said Reverend Cynthia. The MC bounded back to center stage. He looked invigorated. Now, he said, I never thought I'd be introducing a guy like Barry Mason, our guest speaker today. I asked Barry, I said, Barry, how should I introduce you? He goes, I don't know, man, I'm just here to serve. I said, okay, I'm just going to introduce the guy who says, I don't know, I'm here to serve. Give it up for Barry Mason. Barry Mason took the stage to enthusiastic cheers. He was a small man, barely 5.5 feet tall, with a snow-white ponytail hanging down his back. He was wearing black jeans, a black vest, and he moved, coiled with energy, all spring and strut. He clipped a tiny microphone to his vest. I'm wired, he said. I'm wired for Jesus. He held a leather-bound Bible in his left hand, multicolored post-it notes stuck out of the pages, fluttering in the wind. There was a hum of motorcycles in the background as people drove in and out of the parking lot. Barry was born in Georgia to a Southern Baptist family. Y'all can probably tell by the way I talk I ain't from here, he drawled, and this got a good chuckle. Barry's daddy killed a man while in a drunken rage, so after he went to jail, Barry's mama remarried a good Christian. His stepfather took the family to church, although Barry preferred making eyes at girls to learning about hellfire and brimstone. In his 20s, Barry became president of the Charleston chapter of the Hell's Angels, but that wasn't what shaped his worldview. No, he'd seen something worse than bar fights. He'd been in the jungles of Southeast Asia. Barry walked close to the edge of the stage and motioned for people to sit down. They did, drawing their legs up on the hot pavement. Vietnam, Barry said. I remember hippies burning the flag in the street. Our soldiers came back from doing what they was ordered to do to defend freedom, and they was treated like dirt. Now, if you was a hippie, I want y'all to know I forgive you, all right? God's changed my heart, but God has never changed. Barry took a deep breath and looked out at the crowd. I looked too. No one was moving or talking or looking anywhere but up at the stage. Barry opened his Bible and began reading. John 3:16, whosoever believes in him shall never perish. But he goes on, we got to understand that God is a just God too. He loves us, but he hates sin. Now we have a war going on. Our soldiers are fighting, you know, they're fighting for freedom. And we as a nation under God have been ordained to do exactly what we're doing. Hallelujah, came a cry from the back of the parking lot. We might not like it, Barry went on, but in order for the world to be saved, for the world to walk in freedom, someone's got to make a stand. So thank God for America, thank God for the troops, and I pray that America stands with the troops." The applause went on long enough for Barry to take a few sips of water from a Poland Spring bottle. I kept the tips of my fingers in my pockets, hoping no one would notice that I wasn't applauding, but no one was paying attention to me. "Did you all see that movie?" Barry asked. "The Passion of Christ?" Hands went up. "Awesome movie, awesome. When I saw that, I cried, and I got angry. I wanted to cut heads off for what they'd done to Jesus. I'm thankful I had a good brother beside me to say, 'Hey, calm down, Barry. You know, Jesus, he could have come down from that cross any time. See, he loved us so much.'" Barry stopped, tears streaking down his face, his voice cracking. "Jesus loved us so much, he went through every bit of that so you and I might be saved from the powers of darkness, Satan." Amens rippled through the crowd. "The time is coming when Jesus will return," Barry said, dabbing his eyes. "And this is the message for the world today. The world, through his communication, through everything that's happened, through media, satellite, has found out the truth. Now the world is looking to see what real freedom is. And as I look upon America, people in the rest of the world, they want to destroy us because of the freedom that we have, that God established in us. The enemy is always going to rise up." For some reason, people felt compelled to clap at this, too. Ziggy had either been unwilling or unable to tell me the details of the day's organization, but I couldn't help thinking that Pastor Bill might have recognized a kindred spirit in Barry Mason, a fellow sketcher of clean, easily understood lines and divisions between good and bad. The newspaper had ended Bill's writing contract after the church moved to the cinema, whether to cut costs or controversy no one knew, but the pastor kept his opinion circulating via the letters to the editor page and the church's new website. Now anyone with an internet connection could listen to the sermons preached at Faith Free Evangelical, audio clips of bracing radical commentary punctuated by waves of applause. Pastor Bill thrived in front of an audience just as Barry did, and I had heard someone say that there were nearly 1,000 members at Faith Free Evangelical. Who were these people? Apparently they were my neighbors. Had they been here all along? I felt guilty for the second time that afternoon. I was being intolerant of people whose beliefs were different from mine. I was being inconsiderate. These were members of my community. I gazed over at a couple wearing matching American flag hats. They were staring up at Barry. "My life was nothing but hoochie girls and wild turkey," he was saying. "I got in with the angels and run off to California, but I tell y'all what, I had some bad dudes mad at me. For I knew it, I'm hiding out in a $6 motel room with the Hell's Angels beating on the door." The crowd gasped. "I called the only person I could trust," Barry went on, "my mama. And she said, 'Son, your only hope now is Jesus.'" Barry's mama told him to look in the phone book and call the nearest minister, which he did. A local preacher arrived and escorted Barry past the Hell's Angels and down the street to the bus station, where he gave him money for a ticket east. That was the day Barry was born again. "See here," he said, turning around to show the back of his vest. "It says, Born Again, 10/27/76. I made a deal with God that day." Barry let the applause hang in the air for a few seconds, then gestured for quiet. He leaned forward. People leaned forward. "I made that choice," he said, deadly serious. "And I invite you to make the same choice. Now, I do not know what God will do in your life, but I do know this much. If you invite him into your life today, you'll find the truth. God is mercy, but don't forget, he is just. Those who have rejected him have made a choice to live in death. So choose you this day life and choose Jesus. Thank you and God bless." He bowed his head and raised his hands. People applauded, big bearded bikers and little kids in shorts, families, neighbors, everyone, their eyes shining with something that looked a lot like belief or pride or both. The MC returned to the stage, pausing to shake hands with Barry, pumping his arm up and down. "Let's hear it for the Lord," he shouted. There was more applause, a squall of feedback as the amplifiers hummed to life. "Raging Grace will be back in a moment, and I don't know about you, but I'm primed to rock out." There were whoops. "And folks," the MC interjected, "if you feel you have some business to do with the Lord right now, you just look for one of our volunteers. Seek us out. We're here to help you today." People began the slow scattering that crowds do after the event they're attending ends, most of them heading over for a final look at the motorcycles parked in rows 10 deep. I waved goodbye to the Reverend Cynthia, who wiped her eyes and waved back. A fleet of volunteers was circulating purposefully, offering tracts, but I didn't see any takers, no lost sheep being found, no questions being asked. Most of the people the volunteers approached seemed to have their faith well in hand already. I lingered in front of a black and gold Harley painted with crosses wrapped in thorns. It was so clean, it shone. I thought how nice it would be to take it out on a back road somewhere, someplace where the speed limit wasn't enforced too strictly, someplace where you could just ride and ride and go as fast as you wanted. The freedom we have, as it were, that God established in us. An older woman with gray hair and a small knapsack wandered over. She stood next to me, quietly contemplating the bike. An American flag unfurled across her shirt, superimposed with a bald eagle rampant and the words, "America, my kind of country." She turned a little, and I could see what was written beneath that. "Waterville, my kind of town," it said.